are in La Jolla, California, with Martin Rees, officially Baron Rees of Ludlow, who is President of the Royal Society of London. He's also the Astronomer Royal, and he's been Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, since 2004. And I assume you're in town because of the meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science here, which has as its theme Bridging Science and Society.
Yes, indeed. That's why I'm
here. One of your topics. Mm. So just before we launch on that topic, this, of course, is Francis Crick's old home, another old Cambridge man there. Did you cross paths at all?
I met him a few times when he was in Cambridge and once or twice when I went to Salk, but I'd never been to this house, and so it's wonderful to be in a place with such associations with one of the real giants of 20th century science.
Yeah, it's great fun.
And incidentally, someone who you couldn't meet for more than 10 minutes without appreciating was a special intellect. For some scientists, you don't appreciate that at all. But for him, you couldn't be with him for more than 10 minutes without realizing you were talking to someone really special.
That's interesting because your entire life has been interacting with other scientists, many of them extraordinary people as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen a conversation you did once about Stephen mm-hmm. Hawking and so on and so forth. So you have this sort of pantheon?
Mm.
Historical pantheon as well. I mean,
well, historical, but I've been lucky to meet a number of the leading scientists who are active today. Mm. And of course, some of them are immediately impressive, whereas some would not seem impressive if you didn't know their background and their achievements.
If you had a chance to go back in history and meet some people, I suspect you're an astronomer, a cosmologist.
Yes.
I mean, who would you like to have?
Well, of course, Newton probably ranks number one in the intellects of the last millennium. But, of course, he was an extremely unpleasant person. He was solitary when young, vain and vindictive in his old age. And so he was a deeply unpleasant personality. In contrast, Darwin, although he would have been beaten by Newton hands down on an IQ test, is a person who one would have found most engaging and a very fine human being. So in terms of who you'd enjoy meeting, Darwin would have beaten Newton very much.
Yeah. Now, I think I read a piece, because you wrote a commentary on this, because it's, of course, last year was the bicentennial of Darwin's birth and Lincoln's birth. And this year, November 24th was the 150th publication of The Origin.
Right.
So there's been an enormous Darwin industry going on. In terms of celebrations, we also have the 350th anniversary of the Royal Society this year, 2010, origination in 28th of November is the assigned date.
That's when they first had this lecture where Christopher Wren spoke about astronomy at Gresham's College, and those gathered together said they would like to form a society, and regular meetings started from there onwards. And so we trace our origins as a society back to 1660.
Right, although the official royal charter was a couple of years later from King Charles II. Let's just talk about this theme of the AAAS meeting in relation to the 350 years of the longest run, what I like to think of as the longest running uninterrupted science business on the planet,
yes,
the Royal Society, which had, certainly now, and increasingly has as part of its mission, the communication of science. And,
yes. Well, there is a sort of continuity there. If you look at the people who founded the society, they were really polymaths, amateurs, fascinated by travellers' tales from a new world, by experiments with air pumps, blood transfusions, etc. But they were deeply engrossed in the issues of their time. The Royal Society early on published papers on how to manage forests to ensure a good supply of oak for the ships of the Navy, they were concerned with navigation, clocks, and of course the rebuilding of London after the fire. So right from the start, there was not only the curiosity motivation, but also the practical motivation. Indeed, they were inspired by Francis Bacon, who said that there were two motives for doing science, enlightenment, and what he called the relief of man's estate. So those were the two motives which they had. And I would say that they are the two motives which we have today. We pursue science for its own sake, for reasons of curiosity and problem solving, but also we hope that by so doing we will lead to benefits which will deal with the problems of the world. And the difference between then and now is that the founders were concerned with the city of London and not much beyond that, whereas the problems that science has to engage with now are international or global. And that's why science is a global community and its impact is global, and the solutions that it must provide for the world's problems need to be thrashed out by an international community. And that's why AAAS meetings and big gatherings like that are so important.
I always think of the Royal Society as being the instantiation of Francis Bacon's notion in his science fiction novel, The New Atlantis, Ben Salem, the island of Ben Salem, Salomon's house on there, the merchants of light dealing in the commodity of the light of understanding. It's a grand notion. But I always think that that was exactly what was meant, and the Royal Society, therefore, is this offspring of Bacon's ideas.
Yes, they were merchants of light, but they were also motivated by improving man's estate.
Yeah. In terms of moving from then to now, the other thing that happened that Bacon was so instrumental in, and I literally mean instrumental, was the using instruments and doing experiments. That my understanding is that even the phrase facts of the matter or matter of fact was a legal term, wasn't even used in science, because there wasn't even a science as so-called in those days. But Bacon, as Lord Chancellor and a legal scholar, imported that terminology into science and set such store on the experimental method. And of course, we know, as you've already mentioned, the air pump, that would be Boyle and Hooke and so on.
Right, yes, yes.
And Gilbert and so on. So the experimental stuff, hugely important.
Yes, but of course most scientists were then amateurs. Of course, the only scientists who were professionals were medical scientists and I suppose astronomers, who were the first to use elaborate equipment. And as an astronomer myself, I would say astronomy is one of the oldest sciences, the oldest except for medicine, and maybe in fact the first to do more good than harm. But astronomers were professionalized, but physicists and chemists were still really amateurs until the 19th century, I suppose. Mm. And so the big change between science then and now, of course, is the dependence on much more complex instrumentation and the fact that we need to specialize, because the frontiers are so extensive that any individual can only make an impact on a tiny fraction of the frontier. So that's changed the sociology of science completely from what it was in the old days.
Yeah, I want to dwell on this history a little bit, because I found that people are actually fascinated by the history of science, and in many school curricula, it has been scanted. There's no longer much effort spent on the history of science. So I think this is a great moment when you've got the 350th coming
right,
up.
Right, yes.
And as I look back at some of the names of the people who are actually alive during those days, you know, we've mentioned Robert Hooke. The first Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, the first edition edited by Oldenburg. This again is the longest running peer-reviewed science journal that there is.
That's right, and the first editor and the first secretary was a German, showing the international context already, and among the early papers were those by Huygens on improving the pendulum clock, and early ones on microscopy, etc. So it was international, and that indeed set the style for scientific journals and is not too different in the present day, apart from the fact that now there are thousands and thousands of different journals rather than just a few which cover all of science.
But I look back on this biography of Oldenburg and so on, and look at where he was travelling, who was writing to. Spinoza, a great philosopher of science, living in Amsterdam. Oldenburg is visiting him at the time. They're writing back and forth. Milton is alive during this period.
That's right. Milton Newton saw Galileo on his grand tour, yes.
Newton is alive. Robert Boyle, Harvey, Gilbert, Aubrey, Hobbes is alive. This is an extraordinary time. And you mentioned, and interestingly enough, I would like to get back into the origins of what's going on here, because we've just had a civil war in England. A clash between royalists and
Puritans.
Puritans and so on. I suppose as a result of this, on the Mayflower, people come to this country. There's a religious schism, right? And yet there are books, scholarly books, that argue that religion, in fact, was one of the driving forces of the origins of science. And as I look back at the list of Astronomers Royal, and you're currently Astronomer Royal. First man was John Flamsteed, the Reverend John Flamsteed.
Yes.
So here's this. Could you speak to this sort of issue that I'm getting at here?
Well, indeed, many people say that it was the belief that there was some order, which was a divine order, which stimulated people to seek the laws of nature. And certainly this was the motive for people like Newton and many of the people of that time. But also, let's not forget that religion was embedded in society and culture, so very few people would admit to being non-religious even if they weren't.
What would you say the climate is now? I mean, we've as you know, we've done these meetings called Beyond Belief. We've had Richard Dawkins here, Peter Atkins, so on and so forth, Neil Tyson.
Yes.
And there does seem to be a bit of a clash going on between those people who are called the new atheists and a group of people who would think that it's perfectly fine to be a scientist and to think of some higher force, shall we say.
Right, yes.
Does that go beyond liking stained glass windows and singing in buildings and so on, do you think? Or what's the story from your perspective?
Well, there are certainly scientists who adhere to a variety of religions as well as those who are atheists. And obviously no scientist could be a literal creationist, but there are many scientists who adhere to traditional religion, be it Christianity or Mohammedanism or other religions. And I personally believe that there can be coexistence, peaceful coexistence, between science and religion. And I think my one difference with Richard Dawkins is that I agree with him that fundamentalism, both East and West, both traditional and New Age, is a real danger. But I think we need all the allies we can muster against it. And I would see the traditional churches, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Church of England, etc., as being on our side. So I would not want to rubbish the conventional religions, because I see them as being on our side, and rather than regard them as part of the opposition. So to that extent, I regret the strident atheism of Dawkins and people like him. I think it's counterproductive in that it reduces the strength of the alliance against fundamentalism. And another reason too, I think if you were in England, where there were quite a lot of Muslims at school, and if you're teaching science and you tell them that they can't have their God and have Darwin, then they'll choose their God and be lost to science. Far better, therefore, to say they can have both. So I think to that extent, it's counterproductive to argue that there's a complete antithesis between any religion and science.
Mm-hmm. The reason I raise that, obviously, is that if the theme of the AAAS meeting, which is fairly typical of a number of meetings, is bridging science and society, then certainly in this country, that religion comes to the fore. I mean, that's a very powerful issue. So I think it has to be dealt with by the scientific community on an ongoing basis.
Well, the AAAS does in fact do this, doesn't it? It does engage with religion, and I think it's probably a good thing that it does.
You've met with a few people since you arrived. It's a very brief visit, I know. Do you have a sense of what this theme means in terms of pragmatic actions and so on? What's the thrust that people are trying to get together from this meeting, and I assume from the National Academies of Science as well?
Well, I think there's no doubt that young people today are growing up in a world even more moulded by science than earlier generations, and all the issues which confront us are international, and many of them have a scientific dimension. So questions like energy, pandemics, feeding the world, dealing with climate change, etc., clearly all involve understanding the basics of science. And that's why it's important that scientists should engage with the wider community, expressing what is certain, what is uncertain, and putting over the technicalities in a way that's as accessible as possible. Obviously, no one can understand the technicalities of each branch of science, but they don't need to. I think the flavour of science can be imparted without technicalities. I certainly think I can do it in my subject of astronomy, and that can be done, I think, in most other areas. And I think it's important to do that, because science is not just for scientists, in that all the ways in which science is applied have societal and ethical consequences, where scientists as individuals, have no more right to be heard than the average citizen, and therefore we need to have a debate involving everyone. But for that debate to rise above the level of slogans, the public does need to understand a bit about science, to understand that nothing is risk-free, to understand what is well-established and what isn't. And that is the aim of bodies like the AAAS and its counterparts in the UK, to try and engage with the media and with the public and with politicians. And I think in the UK we've had some successes and some failures. We had a failure over GM crops where the debate got polarised between Monsanto on the one hand and the Green campaigners on the other. But we had success in getting a good regulatory framework for stem cells and embryo research because the scientists engaged with parliamentarians early on. We've tried in the case of nanotechnology to engage with the public upstream, as it were, so that everyone knows what the risks and opportunities are before commercial interests become entrenched. And I think that's a model for what we need to do. We need to foresee what the developments in science are going to be that will have societal impacts and handle those impacts by discussing them widely, making the public familiar with them, and ensuring that when regulations are needed, then they are formed on the basis of a consensus.
Mm. Been a couple of wobbles recently in the UK. I mean, the firing of that governmental advisor, whose name escapes me at the moment, on drug policy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in general, you're optimistic about the relationships between government and practitioners of science in the UK?
Well, I think in the UK it's gone fairly well, particularly under the last government. In the US, again, I observe from a distance, but clearly there's been a complete change between the Bush and the Obama administration, and the administration here in terms of rhetoric and substance is very positive about science. But I think in the UK it's also been positive. There are the occasional hiccups, but I think the idea that governments need the advice of the best scientists, but that advice obviously is based on not always complete knowledge, but some uncertainty, is getting through to most of our politicians. But on the other hand, the scientists need to realise that the science is only one input into every political decision. They have to know what the public will stand. They have to bring in the ethics and the economics as well, on which the scientists have no expertise. But I think it's important that when scientists give advice, they should be listened to, and if their advice is not taken, an explanation should be given as to why it hasn't been taken.
Yeah, I've tried this on a number of colleagues, and there seems to me that there's a sort of a, at least the sense of a vicious cycle there, that to get a good story out about the science you're doing, mm-hmm. The journalist has to be impressed and sometimes gets over-impressed and so on, and the story comes out perhaps promising more than the actual science mm-hmm. at that moment is actually able to sustain. And so we end up with this sense that that the public thinks that science delivers certitude. Mm. And then 6 months later in the newspaper, you see the rejection of the claim and the story about the depression gene, don't worry about that, mm-hmm. we've changed our minds on that. Mm-hmm. And then there's a sense of, well, so what else have they got wrong? Mm-hmm. So plainly, science is not in, it's an attitudinal thing. I mean, science is not in the belief business, it's more in the doubt business.
Right, yes.
How does one navigate those waters?
Well, with difficulty, obviously. clearly, as you say, scientists have to give advice, often in contexts where they don't know what the real situation is. I mean, one example in the UK was BSE, mad cow disease, which was an unexpected disease.
This would be bovine spongiform encephalopathy.
Right, yes. The scientists made the first guess, which was there was no danger to humans at all. And that was because it was like scrapie in sheep, which had existed for 200 right. years. And so they made that first guess, and that was a rational first guess. It turned out to be wrong. And then when it was clear it was being transmitted to humans, then, of course, there was a risk it could be a really catastrophic consequence. And then, of course, very elaborate precautions were taken, which in retrospect perhaps were a bit over the top. But that was understandable because one couldn't have ruled out the possibility that once it did transmit to humans, it could transmit in a very big way indeed to humans. So that's an example where the scientists weren't able to give reliable advice. Sometimes the advice is fairly reliable, and there's often a case when there's a strong consensus as to what the situation is, but a maverick element that doesn't go along with it. And there what tends to happen, of course, in the media is that there's a tendency to build up the mavericks in order to have a good debate give a sort of illusion of balance between the two arguments, even when the consensus is very strongly one side rather than the other. So there are these problems when the science is not completely certain. And there's another problem, which is that even though we are fortunate in our specialist science journalists, when a topic gets really newsworthy, it gets out of their hands into the hands of the general journalists who write the front page headlines. And then, of course, things can go wrong. I mean, going back to GM crops, there were headlines, Frankenstein foods, etc., etc. And that really devalued the entire debate. So that's a general problem. And that therefore means that any small issue can perhaps get more legs than it deserves, as it were.
Yeah. Your, let's just circle back for a moment. I said that you've been in the British system given certain honours. You're Lord Rees of Ludlow. Ludlow is, to my memory, a nice small town in Shropshire, which is sort of halfway up on the left in England, just above Wales.
Yes, that's where I come from, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what were the beginnings of this this trajectory?
Well, I grew up in a village in South Shropshire and got into Cambridge. Very lucky to do that, and I read mathematics. I soon realised I wasn't cut out to be a mathematician, and so I then applied the maths and physics I had learnt to astronomy and space science, because I realised I preferred a more synthetic or synoptic style of thinking to try to make sense of evidence, etc. And I thought at one stage of doing economics with some of my friends at economics, but I ended up doing a branch of science which had two very good features. One, it involved trying to mesh together a whole lot of fragmentary data to try to make sense of it, which I enjoyed. And it also had the virtue that at the time I started, it was developing fast. This was the late 1960s, when the first evidence of the Big Bang and for black holes, etc., had come about. And so it was a subject developing fast, and that meant that a young person was not handicapped compared to the old guys because their experience was at a heavy discount. And so I was lucky in my choice of subjects. And I think I've been even luckier in that the subject has continued to advance. I mean, if I look at what's happened in the last 5 years in astronomy, it's just as exciting as any previous five-year period. So I feel I've been able to contribute a bit to the subject, but also participate in a lot of the ongoing debates about what will, when we look back on the history of this period, be among the highlights of science.
Right. So this, this has been very dependent on, this is almost going back to the beginnings of the Royal, isn't it? This has been very dependent on the technology and the equipment used.
Absolutely. I think although I'm a theorist, I would say I'm a phenomenologist, depending on the data. And of course, almost all the advance in a subject like astronomy is due to advances in technology, more sensitive telescopes, and of course also the ability to do computer simulations, because we can't do experiments on galaxies, but in our virtual world in the computer, we can crash galaxies together and see what happens. And that's how we develop our insight. So the advances come not through deep thought, we're no wiser than Newton, certainly, but because we've got access to much better data, much more sensitive equipment, and to computers. But because of those developments, the subject has advanced at a tremendous rate, so we can now address questions that couldn't even have been conceived 20 years ago, and the kind of issues that were controversial when I was starting have now been settled long ago.
So you had radio astronomy, you had people discovering pulsars.
That's right.
And, Anthony Hewish, Jocelyn Bell.
That's right, and also people being able to observe objects so far away that we were looking back in the past to a good fraction of times of the Big Bang, and also more direct evidence of the early Big Bang phases, etc. So it's been an amazing development.
So this goes back to legendary astronomers like Fred Hoyle.
Indeed, yes.
Big Bang.
That's right.
You became his successor, I think.
I did. A rather young successor. Indeed, I was very lucky. I mean, he resigned, and I was then a very young professor at Sussex University, and I came back to Cambridge, where I had been a student, as professor. And I always have hugely admired Fred Hoyle as a real polymath and a really original person who generated more ideas in the subject over the period from the mid-40s to the mid-60s than anyone else. He was a real outstandingly original figure, and also a person who I found a most engaging personality.
You would have been at Cambridge at the same time as Stephen Hawking?
Yes, he was two years ahead of me.
He was ahead of you.
I've known him ever since his student days, yes.
Yeah, I think Sean Carroll, the physicist, has a book out at the moment about time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there's a mention in there of your holding open some book or while Stephen was reading it or something. Because the motor neuron disease was obviously, the Lou Gehrig's disease was obviously moving along quite a pace even in those early days.
Yes, well,
that's amazing. He's.
Yes, well, that must be about 1974, when he'd done a lot of his work on black holes and singularities. but he was starting to think about interlocking quantum effects with black hole physics, and he was already in a very disabled state. And indeed, he could not open or turn the pages of a book, and he would sit motionless in front of a book on quantum electrodynamics, and. I really was not clear anything would come out of it, but out of this came a year later what's probably his best single idea, an idea that unifies gravity and quantum mechanics and thermodynamics in a very insightful way. That's probably his greatest achievement. And of course, it's amazing that that is now 35 years ago and he is still going. Yeah. And so, although the many large numbers in astronomy, fewer as large as the odds I would have given 40 years ago, against him still being going strong 40 years later.
You made the point earlier about the... I often say that one of the things about having these science studio conversations is that although people may not get all of the terminology, that they can eavesdrop on the language and will pick up increase their fluency. And I think that was the point you were making. Your own field is arcane to some extent. Mm-hmm. I've just been watching a couple of lectures on genetics, which are now... The nomenclature is astoundingly complicated.
Yes.
The diagrams, the flow diagrams... It's almost impenetrable unless you're actually working with the bench.
So
the difficulty in conveying the view from 30,000 feet, the real sense of what's important to a lay audience so that they can make an informed decision about something that's going through Congress, for example, or through the... That's a real challenge, I would argue.
It is hard. I mean, in astronomy, it's not quite as hard as in other fields, probably not as hard as in particle physics, nor as hard as in genetics, because people can visualize these things and you can show beautiful images and computer graphics. But it is hard, and some people who write for the general public think that merely by eschewing mathematics, they make it accessible. And of course they don't, because there's a vocabulary, as you say, which is often arcane and is unfamiliar. Even worse, there are sometimes cases when everyday words are used in specialist and misleading connotations. For instance, the word degenerate in mathematics has a meaning which is well defined, but very different from the ordinary meaning of it.
Yes.
So, again, if you're not careful, you can mislead the public by the way you use a vocabulary. So there are these hurdles to be surmounted. But still, nonetheless, I believe it is possible to convey the essence of most of science to a general audience, and certainly enough to allow them to participate in a debate about issues of science which are relevant to public policy. But of course, science is not just important for changing the world. It's a way of understanding the world, and it's part of our culture. And I like to say that science is the only truly global culture, in that protons and proteins are the same wherever in the world you are. Mathematics is the same. So it's the one culture we share with all parts of the world. And as an astronomer, I would say also that the night sky is something which is a feature of our environment, which has been shared by all humans throughout human history. Everyone's looked up at the night sky and wondered about it and interpreted it differently. So we are sharing in something which is part of our common humanity when we think about the stars. So science is important, not just because of its practical import, but because it's part of human curiosity and our common understanding and our common culture. And I would say that anyone who's culturally deprived who can't appreciate something of the amazing story whereby from some mysterious beginning, nearly 14 billion years ago, atoms, stars, galaxies and planets arose, and on at least one of those planets, life began and evolved into the amazing biosphere of which we're a part, and into human brains capable of wondering about it all. So this is part of everyone's heritage, intellectually, in my opinion, and we ought to make it part of everyone's education.
Do you have a sense of when it became part of your mission to sort of communicate these sorts of things? Let me go back a bit. Mm. My understanding from watching a conversation that you had with Alan McFarlane. Mm-hmm. Your parents were teachers, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but didn't think that the local schools were particularly good, and actually set up their own progressive school. Is that right? Is that roughly correct?
Well, they set up their own school, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what did you learn from that experience? I mean, was there some?
Well, I went to that when I was young. I was then sent to a more conventional boarding school when I was 13. So I had a fairly conventional education, and was lucky enough in my teachers to be able to pass the entrance exams into university at the end of that.
Right.
But going back to the question of explaining science, I mean, I did astronomy.
Well, did your parents, were your parents scientists as well?
No. Mm. But when I became a research scientist in my late 20s, I obviously started giving talks to general audiences because there is a demand for that in my subjects. And I have written articles and a few books on these subjects. But in my more recent career, when I've been involved in science policy, I've really seen it as part of my role to engage in the debate on the social aspects of science more generally. And I've enjoyed doing that because, unlike most scientists, I've always been a keen follower of the political process and politics, and so I enjoy participating in debates which have a political context.
Okay, so I read somewhere that you actually don't like writing books, although you do write really good public consumption books.
Well, I don't like writing.
Often you like having written.
As Dorothy Parker said, I like having written, yes. But my books, such as they are, really grow out of articles. I mean, I've written quite a lot of popular articles and given lectures, etc. And once you've got that far, then the extra effort of meshing it together into a book is not all that daunting. And so my books have arisen that way, rather than just from having a concept and starting at the beginning and ending up at the end.
Why don't you mention a couple of these things here? Because, mm-hmm. I mean, if one looks at the reviews or the headlines, mm-hmm. although it was accurate about mm-hmm. some of your books, there are things like, oh, doom and, you know, the end, the last century. Although I think in England it was called The Last Hours, wasn't it, or something?
Well, most of my books are about science, but there's one book which was called in England A Final Century,
right.
And the Americans gave it the stupid title Our Final Hour. I think they liked instant gratification and reverse, as it were. But that was a book which got together some essays and articles I'd written on problems of the 21st century, and I was indeed concerned about the problems we will confront, problems of two kinds, really. The first is that we are collectively increasing in numbers and making greater demands on the resources of the planet and the biosphere and the change of the climate, etc. That's one thing. But also I was worried about something else, which is that individuals are going to be more empowered by technology. So society is going to be more vulnerable to a few dissident individuals than it ever was in the past, because we're in a more interconnected world where individuals can have an effect which is not just local but could be widely dispersed. Mm-hmm. And so this is a social problem which is to be harder and harder for us to confront. So those were two issues which led me to feel that there was a real risk of some serious setback to our civilization. Not wiping us all out, I don't think that would happen, but some setback that could be as bad as a nuclear war. There could be a nuclear war, of course, from a standoff between new superpowers, but there could be other setbacks due to the vulnerability of our ever more interconnected and crowded world.
So on the one hand, science is, to some extent, empowering individuals at the same time.
Well, that's right. But of course, the answer to that is not to stop science. It's right. More and better directed science. So the answer to the problems which science and technology pose is to forge ahead in a more appropriate way.
Tell me about your interest in politics. I mean, is this you obviously got involved in not just being a bench scientist or a theoretical cosmologist, but in actually practical applications. So, I mean, to be a master of a college is a difficult and time-consuming administrative job. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you do that as well mm-hmm. as being president mm-hmm. of the Royal Society, but mm-hmm. that's another massively important mm-hmm. job. And then the Astronomer Royal.
Well, that's an honorary title.
That's an honorary title. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm a research professor of astronomy at Cambridge.
Right, right. So you still obviously have a research agenda
mm-hmm. yep, yep. Mm-hmm.
into dark matter at this point, or what?
Well, dark matter, how the first stars and galaxies formed, and extreme phenomena like gamma ray bursts and quasars.
How do you manage to put all this together, and why did you elect to take on these additional burdens, or these involvement burdens?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd been very lucky and had a fairly straightforward academic life, I felt it would be inappropriate not to take these opportunities and diversify my interests and see if I could make a wider contribution. So I don't regret having done this at all. It's given me new experiences and new insights. And as I say, I have always been interested in social issues and the political process. I've been a sort of voyeur of politics rather than an active participant. But I have been sort of engaged and have had sort of fairly consistent, I suppose, traditional left-wing views throughout my life. Mm.
Mm. You think more scientists should be encouraged to go into take up political careers as well? I mean, I know that Leon Lederman was instrumental in arranging for or encouraging a scientist from Fermilab to become a politician. Just talk to Colin about the member for Oxford at the moment and
indeed.
So on.
Indeed, yes. Well, I think it's good that some people with a scientific background go into full-time politics, but I think it's important that more scientists get engaged in discussions of the political questions which have a scientific aspect. Of course, the science itself is something where academies, the National Academy of Sciences in this country and the Royal Society, can try and make statements about what the best science is. But academies collectively can only comment on science. They can't comment on the policy that should stem from that, because there's a diversity of views depending on your political stance. But I would hope that many members of the Royal Society and of the National Academy would, as individuals, get involved in political discussions about nuclear power or disarmament,
global warming,
all these things. Obviously, they may share a scientific consensus, but they bring different political stances to bear and therefore will not agree on what we should do. For instance, the question of whether we should have nuclear power stations is an issue where opinions divided at all levels of expertise. And it's good that there are people on both sides, and that helps to raise the debate. But I think more scientists should get out of the lab occasionally and participate in these debates, because otherwise they will be left to those who know very little about the subject.
In his inaugural address, and I've mentioned this to a number of scientists, mm-hmm. President Obama said that his administration would restore science to its rightful place. Mm-hmm. Without giving what the coordinates of that
rightful place. Right, yes.
And so I've been asking a number of people in this 350th anniversary year of mm-hmm. the Royal Society, what is the rightful place of science?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I ask you.
Well, first of all, it is an important part of everyone's culture, but more important, it is a basis for the actions we need to do in order to have a safe and just world throughout the rest of this century, because clearly issues of ensuring that globalization benefits the developing as well as developed world, ensuring food supplies, ensuring safety, etc., are going to depend on the proper application of science. And so these decisions have to be based on the best use of science and therefore the best advice being given in to the politicians. And so I think that's what Obama meant. And he also made the statement that politicians should listen to the scientific advice, even when it's inconvenient, indeed, especially when it's inconvenient, because sometimes the scientists are the first to notice some long-term trend, be it global warming, the lights going out because we're short of energy, constraints on food production because of water resources being scarce, all these things which we're going to have to think about. And scientists are perhaps the first to alert the politicians to them. But there's a big problem in all these questions, which is that not only are they often international, but they're very long-term. And of course, in politics, the urgent always trumps the important. And so it's very difficult to maintain these long-term issues, whether it's developing our infrastructure so that clean energy can take over, feeding the world, combating climate change. These are all long-term issues, and the benefits will be in the next generation, not ours. And that's obviously very hard to sell to the present-day public and for politicians to keep high on the agenda.
Well, also think about the way in which information is dispersed these days compared with 1660.
Yes, yes.
And take an issue like global warming, since it's such an important one, since we had the Copenhagen meeting and so on very recently. Clearly, there's a huge number of people out there, or at least a vocal, possibly smaller number of people, attracting an enormous amount of attention saying this is just a bogus issue. I mean, there is no global warming. And, you know, making a fairly strong case out there in the blogosphere and other sorts of places. The communication of this information plainly is now untrammeled.
Yes, yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first, let's say the internet is a wonderful thing. It levels the playing field scientifically. I mean, when I started doing research, it was a tremendous benefit to be in a big centre like Cambridge University, where you were plugged into the community, you got the journals quickly, etc. Whereas now, anyone on the internet gets the papers the same day as everyone else. So it's been a wonderful liberation for scientists all over the world. And of course, in many other ways, it's been a huge benefit. So there's been a tremendous positive. But of course, it has led to a proliferation of information, not all of uniform quality. And one example is climate change and the blogosphere. And obviously this leads to a problem for the person who is an honest inquirer, because they don't know who to believe and who not to believe. But I think this is not an issue which solely is relevant to climate change. It's even more acute in the case of medicine. For instance, suppose you have some unusual disease. You may go to a doctor, but you may also look on the web. And you get a huge variety of comments in the blogosphere on any particular disease. You won't be able to judge which to believe. And in the case of medicine, you'd clearly be unreasonable to give equal weight to the average blog on the internet as you would to a big expert with credentials in medical science. In the case of climate, I would say the same. There is a tremendous diversity of opinions on the blogosphere, and unless one views it with discrimination, one is going to be giving equal weight to the opinions of genuine experts and the opinions of people with no such credentials. And that is clearly a problem, and it's a downside of the huge proliferation of information.